491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 327, recorded on Sunday, October 4th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
So this week, obviously, as we're recording this, folks who are listening around the time will know that there's a lot of fast-moving breaking news happening, and so we did not want to get involved in that because, of course, it would be out of date by the time this airs. And so we thought we'd go way back in American history and talk about armed uprisings in the 1600s because, of course, there's been a lot of discussion this year in the United States around the efficacy of violence for achieving your political goals and so forth. And debating that and you know, whether or not violence is the answer, that kind of thing. So we're going to be talking today about the Boston Revolt of 1689 and the related Leisler's Rebellion of 1689 to 1691 in New York City. And Nate is filling in for Rachel and Kelly today, partly because he read part of a book about this. So what is the book that you were drawing on before we get into kind of the overview on what this period was?
Right. So to take us back for a sec, we both read American Nations by Colin Woodard, which sort of outlines how the various political divisions in America can be traced back to the sort of settlement patterns of the various colonizing groups that came to America, and sort of shows like how the different divisions of that have been reflected in everything going back to the English Civil War, you know, everything. So this book, The Glorious Revolution in America, David S. Lovejoy, subtitled The American Colonists' Violent Attempts in New England, New York, and Maryland to Exploit for Their Own Purposes, England's Religious and Constitutional Crisis of 1688, The Glorious Revolution. So this book is from like the 70s or whatever. Maybe some of the historiography is a bit outdated, not entirely sure, but there was some interesting stuff in the chapter about the uprising, and there's more stuff that I haven't read yet about, you know, going back down to Maryland and things like that. So
yeah, so we're going to talk about a fairly narrow geographical area. We're going to be talking about Boston and New York City. And certainly, as in the book American Nations by Colin Woodard that Nate alluded to, there's a lot in that about differences between New York City and Boston. We'll definitely talk about that as well to some degree. And we're going to also be focusing pretty narrowly on these two revolts and not as much on the wider stuff that happened afterward, although we'll also talk a little bit about that just for context. So let me give some overarching context, timeline of events, geography of events here for both of these rebellions, and then we'll get into it in a little bit more detail. So in April of 1689, an armed militia uprising in Boston mostly ended a short-lived English attempt to consolidate the various colonies of New England into a single Dominion of New England administered by Edmund Andros, an appointee and longtime loyalist of King James II, the former Duke of York, until 1685. Andros had been serving in a very activist role in the province of New York on behalf of James II since before he was the king, and we'll circle back to that point. The Dominion of New England, formed out of its constituent parts over the period of 1686 to 1689, was an attempt to consolidate Massachusetts Bay, Plymouth, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Hampshire, what is now southern Maine, New York City, Long Island, the Hudson River Valley up to what's now Albany, the two halves of New Jersey, and some other areas into a single dominion with an overarching authority directly ruled by England, partly because some of these areas were under a web of conflicting colonial charters, and some of these regions were a personal territory of James II. We'll come back to that as well. These were a mix of both colonies and provinces with various different statuses, and this was an attempt to rationalize it into one unified system. Local colonial potentates were furious in Boston, and not just in Boston, I should say. They were furious about the loss of local power and privileges, such as local town meeting system, the governor's councils of each of the dissolved colonies or provinces due to this merger of colonies, and due to the new direct rule by England. They also disputed taxation powers and import duties. Governor Andros was also explicitly ordered by authorities in England not to allow a local legislative assembly, and some of the colonies already had those. This uprising in 1689 would prefigure many of the developments of the 1770s in Boston less than a century later, which would lead to the American Revolution. There were also religious problems between the Puritans and the Anglicans and the Catholics. So what sparked the uprising in 1689? Well, back in England, Catholic James II had been overthrown by the Dutch mercenary armies of the Calvinist King William III, his sister's son, and Anglican Queen Mary, his eldest daughter, who was also William's wife, and had been, until very recently, the English heir apparent. That coup happened in November of 1688, and it was unexpectedly rapid and nearly bloodless, which is why it's called the Glorious Revolution. Word did not arrive in Boston until April, which finally triggered the revolt. However, in the interim, Governor Andros had heard that there was some sort of a struggle underway in England, and so he had moved the troops out of position from Boston in anticipation of a wider, more protracted transatlantic war between James and William, likely involving the Dutch and the French. The Dutch could have been against King James II if James II had managed to hold on to power, and the French ended up and had been threatening to intervene against the Dutch and against William and Mary's forces in England if they were successful in the Glorious Revolution, which they were, and that triggered, as Nate will get back to, the 9 Years' War, or was part of the 9 Years' War on the European continent, which was called King William's War on the colonial side of the struggle. And there was obviously a lot of other stuff going on involving the Holy Roman Empire as well, but these all did sort of fit together into that. So then this armed revolt in Boston triggered an armed revolt by the militia in New York City called Leisler's Rebellion. And this was an uprising against Andros's military lieutenant governor of New England. As a direct result of the revolt in Boston, and as New Yorkers resisted both the new Dominion of New England arrangement, which had annexed New York a year prior in May of 1688, and English authority on the whole by many of the ethnically Dutch residents of New York City, which had only, you know, fairly recently become English. When the rebellion was finally crushed in 1691 by the consolidated English authorities, and again, it did take them 2 years because there was this wider war happening on the European continent, so it took them a while to actually be able to respond to this crisis, New York City and the Hudson River Valley were restored to the status of a province of New York separate from New England, although they lost several islands to Massachusetts permanently, including Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, among others. Again, in terms of the timeline here, King James II, who was the former Duke of York and Albany, hence both of the names New York City and Albany, in which is the capital of New York State now, had gained personal possession of New York City 25 years earlier as a result of the Second Anglo-Dutch War and a grant from his older brother, King Charles II. This had been reconfirmed in 1674 after the Third Anglo-Dutch War. And final piece of context here, although King William was himself Dutch and had been raised Dutch, the takeover of England was sort of it was authorized by the government in the Netherlands, but it was largely a private venture for a personal union, and it did not survive past his own death. It was not, you know, the case that the monarch that succeeded him, Queen Anne, became the monarch of the Netherlands. They simply went off and did their own thing. So there was not necessarily any certainty among Dutch residents of New York that somehow they were going to get privileged status back or anything like that just because there was a Dutch guy on the throne of England. So there were ongoing tensions there. There were obviously the same religious tensions involving Catholics and so forth. But this situation kind of escalated pretty quickly in New York. As I said, it lasted a lot longer than the situation in Boston. There was various points where the authorities under Jacob Leisler were basically trying to prevent any guns and supplies from going up the Hudson River to Albany, despite the fact that they were under threat from Native Americans and, more importantly, from the French colonial forces. And that was how Leisler eventually managed to force the capitulation of what we would now call upstate New York to his authority. But it was interesting that there was essentially for a little while this armed hostilities between New York City and upstate New York, a tension that remains in less extreme form to present day. So, Nate, let's talk about some of the things from the book. You know, I know the section that you read was mostly more about the Boston situation, which seemed a little bit, I wouldn't say democratic, obviously, but it was a little less dictatorial and autocratic than Leisler's approach in New York City. And I think that kind of speaks to some of the differences between Boston and New York at this time.
Yeah, so the Boston Revolt is interesting because it's not spontaneous, really, but it's also unclear sort of what exactly happened. And this book sort of makes the case that the sensible gentlemen of the city basically sort of staged it, kept the rebellion within manageable bounds, no bloodshed, no uncivil treatment of the prisoners, except for maybe Randolph, one of the guys who was captured, and no surrender to the countryside, although for a time there was little order as armed bands surged down through Boston streets for a day or two after the seizure of the government. The Council of Safety, formed for emergency purposes to govern the colony, included interested parties, except, of course, Andros. And there's lots of merchants involved. But basically, I think that there was an attempt to sort of make it seem like just the sensible, everyone supported it, basically, even though that's not exactly what happened. Reading from the book here, yeah, it came on April 18th with a blast that was unmistakable. On that morning, inhabitants of Boston, or a good part of them, turned out into the streets to the beat of drums. They armed themselves and formed companies with the militia. And there's another guy basically saying, Samuel Prince, then president of Boston, claimed he knew nothing of the outburst until the drums beat and he saw boys and men running with clubs and arms through the streets to the north end of town. The north end, of course, in Boston, a very famous historic place. So, I mean, that's sort of like the vibe, basically. And then they seized the frigate Rose and then started threatening Governor Andros and basically forced the surrender of Castle Island. And basically just like with the implied threat of bloodshed, basically like, yeah, we're going to like arrest you now. And you're not the governor anymore, by the way. So that's that. And then, of course, you could maybe get into all the stuff going on with Increase Mather and his son, Cotton Mather, who are, you know, very famous, influential parts of American history. So as this goes along, quote, sometime during the day, a declaration justifying the revolt was read from the gallery of the town house. It rehearsed the familiar grievances against the Dominion government for the illegal revocation of the charter through unconstitutional taxes and a portion of their lands to the phony war in Maine. Quote, we are again briared in the perplexities of another Indian war. And all these were described against the background of a monstrous popish plot against which England had struggled for years, and now pure New England must battle a plot to extinguish the Protestant religion forever and deliver them all to popery and slavery. So that's sort of what they thought was on the line here. And then meanwhile, as we talked a little bit earlier before we started recording, the fact that all the British troops were up at Fort William, up at Pemaquid, which was sort of the border between New England and sort of New France, Acadia, and their allies with the Wabanaki Confederacy. So that's sort of, if you want to jump back in here, Bill, just because that's sort of like this craziness sort of outburst basically that happened here.
Right. Well, it seems like some combination of, you know, as they called it, this phony war in Maine, right? Like that they suddenly he's moving troops to Maine and there a lot of them are not sure why. And the regular troops didn't get along with the irregular militias. The militias were getting unhappy. And then it meant that the regular troops weren't garrisoned in Boston to basically put down this uprising when it did finally happen. Now, of course, what he knew that they didn't know was that he had gotten word that there was something going on back in England. And remember, Governor Andros was a close loyalist, long time, decades long, and even his father had been loyalist to the royal family, the Stuarts, and specifically James II. But he had gotten word that there was some sort of a conflict underway. And when the Glorious Revolution was initially happening, as I said, it moved very quickly, a lot faster than people expected. And King William was, or the William who subsequently became King William III, was a reasonably competent and, you know, well-regarded military strategist and so forth. And so he basically executed an almost flawless plan that required very little bloodshed. And basically just James II kind of gave up because he had too many people defecting and wasn't sure if he could count on his own troops to remain loyal to him and so forth. But there was a lot of things that could have gone wrong. I was actually reviewing what happened in the Glorious Revolution. There were so many different points where it could have gone completely wrong. There could have been storm, or there almost were various storms, unfavorable winds that created various problems for the Dutch mercenary forces to leave. There were significantly fewer Dutch troops in the invasion than James II had troops at his disposal, although the Dutch troops were a lot better than the sort of hastily convened troops that James II had, and so on and so forth. But there were various points where anything could have gone completely the opposite way and ended in disaster for William. There was also significant risk that the King of France was under the impression that basically he tried to like bluff for a certain amount of time, not exactly bluff, but say like, if you invade England to intervene in the royal crisis there, then I'm going to invade the Netherlands while you have most of your troops in England. And he tried to run out the clock because he thought, oh, you know, they just won't invade after a certain, you know, time of year. And so it'll be, you know, a moot point. And in fact, William went ahead and invaded, as we said, in November anyway, which was not what the French were expecting. So you could have had a situation where if the timing had been slightly different, then France could have invaded the Netherlands earlier and basically prevented this. So any number of things could have happened that could have completely changed the direction of this intervention coming from the Netherlands and William and Mary. And so it could have been a totally different outcome. And so Governor Andros, being aware of that with at least the initial reports, and it is kind of interesting, you know, we were talking at the beginning of the episode about how there's so much fast-moving breaking news, and this is the polar opposite, where there's all this fast-moving breaking news that just takes months and months to filter back to the colonies across the Atlantic. He started moving troops to the French frontier, anticipating that there could be a situation involving the French, whatever the outcome was in England, that there could have been a situation involving the French, or that there could have been a resumed, you know, war with the Dutch. There could have been a full-scale Anglo-Dutch war again, and maybe they were going to try to retake, because actually they had at one point retaken New York City in one of the wars, and it was only by treaty that it was returned. So it was definitely conceivable that this could have been an escalated situation. This is a not as well known, I think, as people, I mean, not that Queen Anne's War is super well known either, but Queen Anne's War, which was the colonial battle side of the War of the Spanish Succession, happened under the successor monarch, Queen Anne. But this King William's War did prove that it basically did, in fact, escalate, and that there were conflicts with the French, right? So, you know, that this was one of the situations that, you know, complicated things in Boston.
Well, also looking back at King Philip's War before that, like the colonists did not win in Maine. They lost, and the Maine fishing industry was decimated. So, I mean, that's sort of like the environment we're talking about here. I'd also recommend people go to Fort Henry. There's the remains of it because it was burned several times and everything, but very beautiful, lots of cool history there. And Pemaquid Point Lighthouse is right nearby. It's on the Maine State Quarter, very beautiful. Do not go swimming in that area. You probably will drown. But just going back to the book here, interesting, it says that the rebellion bears no specific name, may be significant in itself. It might tell us that the leaders of the uprising wanted to be remembered as widely supported undertaking, a unanimous outburst of the people, as the declaration described, and Mather and the agents contended to England. Therefore, it needed no name, only to be chalked up to the will of God. But then sort of makes the point that the various groups that sort of came together to do this, then, of course, once it was over, then they just sort of went back to their disagreements. And, you know, Massachusetts revolutionaries had agreed long enough to form a huge majority capable of overthrowing the Dominion. Once this was accomplished, they saw fewer reasons for agreement. In fact, were at loggerheads for some time over the future of the colony. That sort of points to this was sort of a moment in time, I guess, that just like, and because Boston at the time was like such a, it's like a peninsula, like a little port town. Like you could just like, if you controlled the neck, as the British learned when they got like pinned there during the Revolutionary War, like it's not a great situation you want to be in. It's, you could easily control the city quite quickly if you had armed gangs.
Now, as you said, the situation in Boston was that you had various, New England authorities who were all sort of, I mean, it was basically a merchant oligarchy uprising with mobs backing them and militias backing them. But they were all representing their various local powers in towns across the New England. They were representing the fact that there had been, you know, these different, like you'd have New Hampshire people and Massachusetts people and maybe some Plymouth people and Connecticut people and Rhode Island people and so forth. And there had been a lot of resistance to Governor Andros as he was in the process of doing these annexations over the 3 or so years preceding. And then, of course, certainly, as we said, in New York City, very, very stiff resistance to this. But as you said, completely different situation in New York, where we do remember it by the name of a specific person, a guy who was ended up being executed for this, Jakob Leisler, a German merchant. And, that he basically, the lieutenant governor, there was a rumor that he had said he was going to burn New York City to the ground rather than see his authority challenged. And so they did a preemptive strike to take the fort away from him and, you know, oust him from power and so forth. Then it became this sort of much more dangerous situation, whereas in Boston, they achieved their relatively short-term political aims and then kind of dispersed from there, and they were not forced to go back to the previous system. So kind of an interesting contrast there, certainly. So, Nate, I guess the other thing that I wanted to talk about before we close this out in the next several minutes is just this. As I mentioned, a lot of, in my sort of summary of the some of the readings here, a lot of this feels like a big foreshadowing of what happened in the 1770s. And so I was wondering if you could pick out some of the similar themes with me.
Well, I mean, I was sort of joking about it as I was reading some of these quotes, because there was literally a declaration, you know, like it's all, I mean, and also if you read about the history, I remember we took a class in high school, and our teacher like exposed us to sort of like a different historiography of the Revolution that basically posited that it was mostly Boston's fault,
to Boston.
Yeah. Either way, you know, it was like basically Sam Adams had like armed gangs like roughing up the redcoats or whatever, or the British colonial officials, and then sort of things spiraled from there.
Like, yeah, I mean, we had the same, like,
the, and that is a plausible interpretation.
Attempt to impose direct rule from England, attempt to dissolve the local legislative assemblies, tensions over the governor's councils, taxation powers, and import duties. Things like that, I feel like there's very clear echoes there, right?
Yeah, of course. And, you know, this clearly presaged the situation, because, and also we're talking about like purely just the physical geography of Boston. You, as I was saying, you can shut it down. You could like row across from Charlestown, and like that's the whole thing. Like one if by land, two if by sea. Like this is all, it's all the same thing, pretty much. That's what it seems like, anyway.
I think it's also important to understand how kind of baked in a lot of the threat of the French and the ongoing threat of the indigenous peoples was to this. Like, that is something that has definitely come up a lot lately, is the way that settler colonialism sort of pervades the United States and American culture. But it's easy to kind of forget some of the extent of that because it is so far removed from us now. But of course, like a big distinction between this uprising in the, 1680s and into the 1690s versus, say, the 1770s after the settlement of the Seven Years' War and the French and Indian War in the American colonies, is that France loses almost all of their colony, or at least they lose their northern colonies in North America. The, you know, Quebec, the area around Maine, the area in upstate New York, and, you know, the upper Midwest and Great Lakes regions and so forth, and into, you know, Appalachia and all that. This changes the dynamic, I think, fundamentally, where there's a lot less risk to the, I mean, there that we, you know, we always talk about, oh, they were pushing for more settlement across the Appalachians, and the English authorities didn't want to allow that to happen for various reasons. And partly it's because they didn't want to have to maintain all of the garrisons, the frontier garrisons against the natives. But I think that, like, there is a less risky environment for an uprising to take place once the French threat has been eliminated and the native threat has been changed. The dynamic has been changed there with the elimination of French support.
Right. Yeah. And we were talking a little bit earlier just about the French and Indian War and how that sort of, like, fundamentally shapes America, if you think about it, just even due to the fact that George Washington was a participant in it. Like, that's what this all is, pretty much.
Right. All right, so that is about enough on this for today. We just wanted to kind of talk about, because it was a little interesting thing. I don't even think I had ever heard about the Boston Revolt of 1689. I don't know about you, and I certainly hadn't heard about Leisler's Rebellion, so we wanted to talk a little bit about that.
I feel like I vaguely heard the name Leisler once or whatever, but yeah, I certainly did not know a ton about this this uprising, and it's been interesting to see some of the echoes that, you know, it has a cast throughout history, I guess. So,
all right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Great to be here, Bill.